This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Real fear is scary, while seeking out experiences that make us afraid are exhilarating and exciting and fun. Think about the popularity of roller coasters. The faster and steeper, the better. The appeal of monster movies or even slasher films. The long lines for haunted houses around Halloween time. Our guest, Margie Kerr, works at Scare House in Pittsburgh collecting data on visitors, the perfect venue to study what people find hair-raising. She's put herself through some frightening experiences walking the narrow catwalk at the top of the CNN Tower in Toronto and riding the Fuji Q roller coaster in Japan. She spent time in the hole at Eastern State Penitentiary here in Philadelphia to understand how the body and mind reacts to the terrors of solitary confinement. She's a sociologist at the University of Pittsburgh, author of a new book called Scream, Chilling Adventures in the Science of Fear. Margie Kerr, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here. Thank you.
You're welcome. So what makes Scare House in Pittsburgh so scary?
Well, Scare House does care a lot about what customers are experiencing, which is where I came in back in 2008 to analyze the customer response data and to really see what people were saying. You know, this experience is for customers. It's for people who are looking to have a good time. So Scare House as a business always paid a lot of attention to what they were saying. And they had asked a lot of open-ended questions that needed some analysis. And so I went through all of the open-ended questions from customers looking for what they found scary, what they like, what they don't like, created a whole code book that had categories like monsters and, you know, different ways to die. And it was a very interesting code book. But, you know, Scare House then, you know, uses that data to give to the designers who create experiences around what people are saying in this time, in this place, what they want to see, what they're going to respond to.
Are there some universals, some things that people get frightened by?
Sure. Mostly the universals are the scares that are going to startle us, whether it's a flash of light or a burst of sound or a burst of air. You know, we're going to have a arousal response to that pretty immediately. So those are always, you know, tested in and work for everybody. But in terms of the characters, they do change based on time and place, whether it's zombies or witches or ghosts or creepy kids. You know, that's going to change, you know, across the board.
You have a description in here of walking around this CNN Tower, which is in Toronto, almost 2,000 – is it almost 2,000 feet tall?
Yes,
like
I believe it's 117 stories, so I think 1,600-some feet.
Very tall.
Yes, yes, very tall.
And this is a tourist destination. People go to walk around the very outside of this CNN Tower.
Yeah, the tower was built as a communications tower, and it was at the time the tallest building in the West – well, in the world. Now it's still the tallest in the Western Hemisphere. And it didn't originally have a catwalk around the outside, but they introduced that, I believe, in 2011. And so people can go up to the top now and walk around the outside. There are no railings or anything. It's just you in a harness and a metal grate, and then lots and lots and lots of feet below you.
Yes. In fact, you have this description, I have to say, and my palms are sweating right now. Yeah. But as I was reading the book yesterday, my palms are sweating just imagining being at that height. Now, you do have a harness on and you have kind of a jumpsuit on as well.
Yeah, they put you in a harness. They tie you in about five different ways. The safety checks are extreme and thorough and necessary. So there's no doubt that you are safe, that you're not going to fall over the edge at all. But as soon as I stepped outside and looked down, it didn't matter. You know, my rational thinking, my executive functioning, my brain just stopped thinking and said, you can't fly. You're going to die.
Is that right? I mean, you said this is the end?
Yeah, I really thought, oh my gosh, this is crazy. And it is, because when we're in that that threat response, that high arousal state, our thinking brain isn't getting messages through. You know, our body is saying we need to prioritize all of these messages that are going to help us survive. And so I wasn't thinking rationally, and I really did think that, you know, I was going to die.
Well, even more than just sort of tiptoeing around the edge of this building, there were actual things that you were doing. I mean, kind of leaning off.
And, yes.
I mean, this is all part of the tourist attraction, I guess.
Right, yeah. So the guide has you lean over. There's a series of stunts that you do as you make your way around the whole tower. And the first one is that you have to, you know, push your feet back. So you're basically, you know, hanging over the edge. And
face up or down?
Face up. Later we would do face down. That was a whole new scare. But yeah, and it's just, it doesn't matter how many times I told myself that I was fine. I was safe. Everything in me just did not want to push my feet back and, you know, and feel that intensity of looking beneath you and knowing that if you do fall, there's nothing that's going to save you.
But you said some photographs of you at this time, you were smiling.
I was smiling.
Now, that's so interesting to me.
Yeah.
You were terrified and you were smiling.
I was terrified. And to watch the video afterwards and remember what I was, you know, feeling and thinking, and then see that my face, you know, was smiling. After, admittedly, after maybe the first 5 or 6 minutes, I think those first 6 minutes I was probably just whitewashed, sort of staring into the distance. But yeah, I was smiling because, you know, my body was just so overwhelmed, I think, with all of the different responses that go with fight or flight. And just the exhilaration of challenging myself in such a unique way and just feeling.
How'd you feel the rest of the day?
Oh, amazing. I when I got to the bottom, I told a friend who had gone with me, I said, I can do anything right now. I mean, anything. And I
Superwoman, thinking, right?
Yeah, I really did feel like Superwoman. And when you're up there, you do have the chance to kind of do your favorite superhero pose. And it is powerful. It's an amazing, amazingly powerful experience.
Well, what's interesting, and we're talking about, you know, safe, scary things. And I think safe is an important thing that we should talk about, because there are scary things that happen that mm-hmm. are just truly frightening.
Right.
Being in a car accident is one of the most obvious things. But these are people like yourself seeking out scary experiences, knowing for the most part you're going to be safe.
Right. Yeah. It's the difference between, you know, safe, controlled, consent, choice, and the opposite. It's the difference between enjoying something and real trauma.
Right.
And, you know, when you enter voluntarily into a situation where you know you're going to have a very intense experience, you don't have to worry about your safety. You can kind of set that on the back burner and allow yourself to be afraid. You know, you make an environment safe and all of a sudden you can be afraid and play with that response and learn more about yourself and sort of test out what your emotional reaction is going to be and enjoy it.
I mean, you talk about a kind of dopamine rush, right? I mean, there are physiological things that happen, I guess hormonal things that happen under these circumstances.
Yeah, our body is amazing. Our body has this really well-developed, evolved threat response that, you know, sets loose a chemical cascade with, you know, things like dopamine and endorphins and serotonin, oxytocin, all of these things that can make us feel really good. And in a safe environment, we can, you know, bring a meaning to that and say, oh, okay, well, you know, this actually feels okay and I'm safe. So I'm going to go ahead and allow myself to enjoy it. And there are differences in the responses that individuals have. Some may not have the same kind of extreme, you know, physiological response. And that has been linked to, you know, whether people really like thrill seeking or sensation seeking or not.
And you're a thrill seeker. I mean, you like this, and it seems like you've liked this since you were a little girl.
I do, yeah. I grew up riding horses and roller skating and just, you know, running breakneck speeds down hills when I probably shouldn't. And yeah, I think that I've never had any testing done, but I assume I probably have very efficient dopamine and endorphin systems at work.
Do you think it's also that when we test ourselves this way, even if it's a controlled test environment, and we survive. I mean, there is a sense of survival that also is euphoric.
Yeah. I mean, we're the descendants of, you know, humans who've had the right balance of curiosity and the right sort of balance of caution. And we evolved to really reward ourselves when we do those activities that take us on adventures, that take us to new food sources or new places to find new mates, or you know, that has been sort of reinforced over time, and so that we do get a joy out of challenging ourselves, and that makes sure that we continue to do those difficult things. So even, you know, in these places where you may rationally know that nothing is going to hurt you, the payoff psychologically and physically is still very real.
Well, I'm thinking of those faces. I mean, you know, you study people in Scare House in Pittsburgh, so you see faces, people, eyes wide open, hands over their mouths, often screaming and laughing, which is an interesting combination.
Yeah, that's one of the things that just caught my attention, and that is really I love to see. Spending many years, you know, at Scare House behind the walls, watching people go through, and what I would see again and again is that they would scream and then immediately afterwards start laughing, and it was almost as though I could see that message, that threat message, going from you know, oh no, something scary, to realizing, oh, but wait, we're safe. And then you know, the brain, the body is already there in that high arousal, and it's just the context that switches, and you say, oh, I'm safe. And so that fear turns to laughter and excitement and just exhilaration.
Well, it's interesting because when you look at someone's face on a roller coaster, but you're not hearing the sound, you can't often tell, is someone actually scared, terrified, wish they hadn't gotten on this ride, or are they enjoying themselves? And it often looks very similar.
Yeah. Yeah. And at the in haunted houses, actually one sign I look for when people are not having a good time, or those who are not having any response. You know, those who are just like, this is too much, too intense, and they're just have essentially shut down. And you know, for those folks, it's like, okay, let's, you know, maybe go take a walk and remind
do
them.
Something different.
Yeah, yeah.
We're almost having a break here, but I read that you had for a time a fear of bridges. I don't know if you still do as well.
Yeah.
How serious a fear?
You know, a lot of my fear of bridges, of boats too. I'm very impulsive.
and boats so, as well.
Yeah, anything that I could potentially, you know, jump over or fall off of.
But not 100 story buildings.
Well, yeah. When I went to the CN Tower, at first I thought, oh, this isn't going to be scary. I'll be, you know, attached to the wall. There's no chance of me, you know, falling or jumping over. And with bridges and anything that's sort of cliffs too, like the Grand Canyon, in my head I'm thinking, okay, I'm so impulsive. What if I just jump? And so it's almost a fear of myself, because, you know, I could think, oh, that could be really fun. I could probably, you know, jump off of this bridge and get into the water. But
yeah, don't do that.
No.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation with Margie Kerr. She is a sociologist at the University of Pittsburgh. She also works at Scare House in Pittsburgh, collecting data on visitors about what scares people. And she's the author of a new book. It's called Scream: Chilling Adventures in the Science of Fear. And we want to hear from you if you enjoy roller coasters and haunted houses and scary movies and monsters. Call us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Margie Kerr about Scream, Chilling Adventures in the Science of Fear. That's her new book. We're talking about what makes scary things so much fun. And here's a couple. They're on a roller coaster, and they're talking to each other as we hear this short clip, and then you will hear some screaming. Let's give it a listen.
Are you all right? Rich, I am... Oh, my God. Rich?
No.
Oh.
Oh, no!
Yes!
and even funny to hear these kind of disembodied screams. What did you hear there, Margie?
Well, one thing I heard is how infectious, you know, screaming and laughing is. And, you know, that's why a lot of these experiences are better when you do them with friends, because we see our friends laughing and screaming and we can't help but do the same and join in. And there's a lot of research that's gone into that, you know, how co-attention sort of can amplify whatever emotional experience you're having. And so, yeah, it's just you see your friends screaming and having a great time. And the way that we sort of empathize with people is we experience sort of what they're experiencing to a slightly smaller extent. And so we're both there together. And it just is a ton of fun.
You went to Japan to ride the Fuji Q Highland?
Yeah, the amusement park is Fuji Q Highland. And then there are a ton of thrill rides and roller coasters and record-breaking and current record-holding coasters there. They have the fastest at takeoff.
Which is how fast, you know?
I think it was, it was either 60 or 90 miles an hour.
At takeoff?
Within seconds.
So it just like shoots you out of the...
Yeah, it does. And what's really evil is that before it actually takes off is they have two false starts. So you know that feeling when your body is bracing and you feel it coming and so your whole body is tense, and they would do a false start where you just would feel like you have left your stomach, you know, behind. And then all of a sudden, before you could, you know, prepare again, you're off and going. And
wow.
It's just it just completely knocks every thought out of your mind and you're just completely in your body.
And you're going, what, upside down? And I was looking at Fuji Q online yesterday, mm-hmm. and just this sort of mass of tracks
wrapping
around each other.
They have a 4D coaster, which is not only does it go upside down and around, but the actual chairs, the cars themselves rotate. So you are rotating while the track is rotating, while the car is going and speeding along the rails. And it's the most ultimate form of disorientation I've ever experienced.
Really?
You don't know which way is up, and it's really just exhilarating.
And as part of the appeal is you just can't think anymore. I mean, sort of stop whatever chatter might be going on in your head.
Yep. And, you know, that's what I love about, you know, very intense kind of thrilling, scary experiences is that it is taking my thinking brain offline and just giving me a second to feel very, you know, very primal in a sense, sort of just in your body, just in this moment.
It's interesting that people, and I would include myself, have fears of things like snakes. Now, you know, in my lifetime, I've run across snakes in the woods and things like that, but, you know, nothing mm-hmm. horrendous, or I had never had a traumatic experience. And yet, for many people, I don't know if it's hardwired, there is this kind of primal response to certain kinds of creatures, I guess.
Yeah, there's been a lot of research trying to discover if we do have these hardwired fears to things like snakes and spiders. And there's even a snake detection theory that we've evolved to sort of be better at spotting things like snakes. And you know, it hasn't been definitively shown that we do have some sort of hardwired snake, you know, fear center in our brain. But the characteristics of snakes are inherently scary. You know, they move in very unpredictable ways. They're difficult to see. And so when we do see them, it's a kind of startle. They, you know, in a lot of ways introduce this dissonance, like, wait, it doesn't have any feet. How is it moving? Yeah. If you ever see a snake swimming in water, it just... It's terrifying to see because our brain is saying that does not look right. But yeah, they have seen that, you know, people who have never, you know, seen a snake before will have a threat response to it. And it's likely because the characteristics of the snake are so unpredictable and scary.
Would you suggest that, I mean, not everyone likes to do this stuff, but would you suggest that it's actually healthy for people to ride a roller coaster, go to a haunted house, go to a scary movie, that is actually good for us?
I think that the part that is really good for us that's healthy is challenging ourselves to expand our emotional range, to be comfortable with the full sort of ability of our emotional experience, that we can know what our threat response feels like, that we can know, you know, even what sadness, what just the full spectrum. I think people, you know, benefit when when we push ourselves in those ways. And, you know, the critical part is that it's a conscious sort of decision, a choice to say, I want to challenge myself to experience this and then, you know, grow from it. And it can be reflective, too. You know, you can experience something and say, you know, that was not a great mm-hmm. experience, but mm-hmm. this is what I learned. And, you know, this is what I felt, and now I know that about myself, and carry that information to the next emotional experience. So I do think that it is very good for us to push ourselves.
Are there experiences that you've had where once you were done, you said, you know what? I really didn't enjoy that.
Yeah, there are. There are some thrill rides that I do not like. Yeah,
such as?
I'm not a fan of the anti-gravity ones, the spinning. I think my vestibular system is not the best, and I get very dizzy, and you know, in the moment it's okay, but then afterwards the dizziness is just too uncomfortable for right. me. I mean, a little bit is okay on a roller coaster, but something about the anti-gravity, really extreme spinning for a very long period of time is just, I just don't like that. Yeah.
Years ago, I remember going rock climbing with some friends, and I rappelled down. That was mm-hmm. okay. Climbing back up, I was so terrified. I became almost like catatonic on the yeah. side of this cliff. I mean, I did learn some things about myself, including the fact that I will never rock climb again,
yeah.
but it was absolutely terrifying.
Yeah. Yeah. There's some things that, that I do know, you know, that's not going to be fun. Yeah. Not going to do it.
Yeah. Let me just quickly reintroduce you. And that's, Margie Kerr, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. We're talking about why we, not all of us, but why we enjoy things like roller coasters and haunted houses and scary, fun, safe things to do. We want to know if that's you. You can give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, perhaps share some of your experiences. A tweet from a young poet, funny you should talk about jumping off cliffs. I've had the same thought at the cliffs by my college. Then I actually fell. It was crazy, amazing experience. Wouldn't go back to change it, but wouldn't recommend it either. I was silent the entire way down. Pretty scary for people, blah, blah. He goes on and on and
yeah.
on saying
yeah.
he was on a cliff. I guess he slipped and fell.
Yeah.
Thank goodness he survived.
Right.
But nonetheless, you know.
Yeah, there's that for those, you know, who are thrill seekers and sensation seekers, I think that there's a lot of impulse control issues there. And so when you know that about yourself, and you know that if something looks like it's going to be a lot of fun, you have to sort of stop yourself and say, okay, let's right. bring some very right. critical thought to this, and maybe that's not such a good idea.
We have a Facebook comment from Amanda. Is it common for a person's scare threshold to decline as they get older, or perhaps even have children? I'm a mom of three, and I've started to notice that thrill rides at amusement parks make me more nervous than in the past. Interesting question.
Yeah, I've talked to a lot of people who said that their desire or enjoyment in scary or thrilling activities decreased after they had kids. And I think it's because, you know, it's one thing to worry about your own safety, but then to worry about your child's safety, or, you know, what would happen to your children if you were to be hurt. And so the threshold can change, you know, and all of a sudden things that you would be willing to do right. in the past are now more terrifying. And then also our body is changing as we age too. So things like our vestibular system may not be as good as when we were young kids. And so the disorientation doesn't feel as good. So yeah, we definitely do change our fears as we age.
Have you done skydiving?
I have. And I originally, you know, skydiving was part of my master agenda of adventures. But when I went skydiving and I reflected on it and I was reading through all of my notes, there was no fear there at all.
You jump by yourself?
It was tandem. So,
right.
But it was the most fun, exhilarating experience I had ever had. And it's what was shocking is how afraid I was on the CN Tower, but how just blissful I was jumping out of a plane. And, you know.
And is it because it was tandem in a way? I mean, you weren't entirely alone.
I think it was because, you know, after the jump, there's nothing left to sort of, like, you're done. You're, you know, on the CN Tower, it's a constant state of, you know, looking down and thinking I could fall. Whereas when you're actually falling, you're just sort of, well, you can't really worry about anything now. You're on your way down. Either the chute's going to open or it doesn't. And so it was just, it was amazing. I felt so wonderful. But yeah, I wasn't really scared.
Would you do it again?
I wish I could do it every day. I think,
really?
That, yeah. I think if I were able to start the day by jumping out of a plane, every day would be a good day.
Let me see what Alex from Downingtown has to say. And Alex, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello.
Hi there, Alex. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. So my question is, what role does anticipation play in this whole kind of fear response?
Yeah.
Yeah. So anticipation. So when I'm watching a horror movie, sometimes it's really uncomfortable because things jump out and I don't expect it. And it's an unpleasant sensation. But if I kind of put myself in a different mindset, it can be more exhilarating than uncomfortable.
Oh, that's great, Alex. I appreciate the call. Go ahead, Margie.
Yeah, anticipation is definitely part of the enjoyment part. You know, when we are in a state of anticipation, that's when we're also releasing dopamine. So, for example, when you're doing the slow increase on a roller coaster,
just
going to the
that.
Apex, and you know it's coming, and you're waiting, and you're waiting. Or when you anticipate that the startle is going to come in a haunted house or in a scary movie, that heightened state, you're in this sensitized kind of ready-to-go state, and our body at that moment is just really on fire with all of the different sort of chemical reactions that are going on. And then when it finally happens, it's a state of relief. You're like, oh, okay. You know, now it's very much the fear of the fear is the real fear. You know, the anticipation of what's to come is the real sort of fear. And then once it's finally presented, you can actually relax.
Alex, are there certain kinds of scary movies that you enjoy?
Any kind of thriller, things that jump out when I can kind of see when I can anticipate that moment. I say, no, wait, now.
Yeah.
I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Thanks so much, Alex. And again,
you're
welcome. You can call us at 1-888-477-9499 talking about things that scare us, that we enjoy scaring us. There was a comment from Heidi says, I've never understood why people love haunted houses. Why would they want to be scared? Life is stressful enough. But this is an interesting sort of dichotomy here. Mm-hmm. There's real fear and really terrible things that do happen to people.
Yeah.
We're not really talking about that. This is the sort of orchestrated fear, I guess, that allows us to enjoy it.
Yeah. And, what we've found and what I've seen in the data and also talking to people is that for those who do have a lot of stress, who do have a lot of anxiety, going to a haunted house, going to see a scary movie can actually bring a sense of relief from those, real fears. You know, here are opportunities to bring things that we're afraid of into our control and under our own terms. You know, if we're constantly worried about things like finances or violence or things that are legitimately very scary in a not fun way, we can go to a haunted house or scary movie and there we're experiencing it on our own terms and feel a sense of closure, a sense of completion and sort of mastery over that fear. And there's a big difference between the acute threats, these startles and roller coasters and chronic strains, chronic threats.
I think they call that systematic desensitization. The idea is that you sort of introduce yourself to things that you might find scary.
Yeah. And it does feel good to have sort of a threat response, or it can, in a space where you are controlling the outcome.
We have an email about the platform that juts out from the Grand Canyon. I think I've been on and you can actually
look down, right?
The glass. Right.
Oh,
now, what's your take on that, Margie?
It's very similar to being on the CN Tower when your rational brain, your thinking brain knows that you're fine, knows that you are not going to fall through the glass, but that very old part of the human species is saying, this isn't right. Something is not right here. And you just can't help it but become terrified.
Well, I only say this because you wrote it in the book. When you were on the CNN tower, you weren't sure whether you'd peed in your pants or not.
I really thought that I had. You know, the wind was blowing so hard and I just was so disoriented. I had really no idea which way was up. And then my body was just so warm. And I thought, oh my gosh, you know, I must have peed my pants. The jumpsuits that we were wearing, it felt like I had. And it's, you know, because my body was in this threat response and my metabolism was kicked up and I'm, you know, yeah. just feeling more warm. But I thought for sure that I had. But I didn't. So that was...
In the chapter on the roller coasters, you talk about the Russian ice slides. I mean, some really fascinating, I guess, historic roller coasters.
Yeah, the modern day roller coaster is an outgrowth of these slides that in Russia that people would, you know, go to the top of a hill and slide down, and it became more sophisticated as time went on. They would introduce little, you know, bumps and make it more interesting, and then eventually they started building wooden Russian ice slides to try and replicate the natural mountain. And then from there, we started seeing what we now know as, you know, more modern day roller coasters. So the history of the roller coaster is very fascinating. And it's also very tied to advances in technology. You know, once the trolley car was introduced and, the people saw that people enjoyed riding trolleys, especially when they were going up and down hills. And so they thought, well, let's start selling tickets to ride the trolley just for fun. And
I have to say, and again, going back to Fuji Q and in Japan, just the complexity. I mean, talk about engineering and design.
It's amazing. I mean, these roller coasters are billions of dollars, billions and billions of dollars for, you know, a 3-minute ride. And I think if anything else, like, that speaks to how enjoyable these things can be, that we are, you know, spending that much money for to elicit this response in ourselves. The engineering behind it is, you know, amazing. And I think that if I had a more engineering mind, I would definitely want to do something like creating, you know, thrill rides. But the problem now is that technology has gotten to the point where we can create rides that go over that point of safety and fun. You know, the sort of quest to be the fastest and the highest with the most loops is really in many ways over, because people, you go above, you know, 6 G's and that's where you get into real danger.
You're going to hurt yourself.
Yeah, and it's just not fun. So I think we're going to see more creativity in roller coaster design now that we can go as fast as we really want. Well, not quite, but...
Not quite.
Yeah.
Let's take that short break and we'll get back to our conversation. I'm talking with Margie Kerr. Her book is called Scream, Chilling Adventures in the Science of Fear. We have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Lots of emails as well. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Sorry, folks. We couldn't resist. That's a compilation of screams from a number of different horror films. And do you have a good scream? I mean, are you a good screamer?
I don't know. You know,
do you know what your scream sounds like?
It's hard to hear your own scream when you're really screaming loudly, because you kind of, you know, can't hear anything. And usually when I'm screaming the loudest is when I'm on a roller coaster, so there's so much noise. But
yes.
But I hope I have an ice cream.
Let me see what Bill from Westchester has to say. And Bill, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
First, quickly, I'd like to say our language remembers there's a line here. Some sense of awe is awesome, but you get too much and it's awful. So there's a balance there. But what I wanted to say is I am a storyteller. I'm about to head into a month of scaring the pants off of kids. And I often get pushback from the adults about, you know, the world's scary enough that we really need to scare these kids with these, you know, ghost stories and everything. And I always say that it's a great experiential preparation for life, because life is scary. You know, I took my kids around when they were little in the scariest darn house in the neighborhood, with the fog and the lights and the guy jumping out of the bushes with the axe and everything, had the best candy. And the kids knew if they could walk down that walk and face their fear, they got that great reward. And that's a great preparation for life. You know, you want to ask your boss for a raise, scares you, but or walk in and tell your boss you're leaving, start your own business, terrifies you. But that's how you get the rewards, is being able to face those fears. If you don't, you know, you go nowhere in life. So,
well, Bill, I know it's a great comment. Yeah. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And as you're talking, I scribbled down the word fairy tales. I mean, talk about scary stories. But I'm curious.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Margie.
No, I think it is important for kids to experience, you know, stressful situations in a safe environment where they can learn that they can deal with stress and be okay. You know, there's a lot of research now looking at the consequences of, you know, helicopter parenting, or, you know, raising kids to the extent that you are not allowing them to experience any type of stress. And that means that when they do experience stress, because we will all face real fear, they have no skills to cope with it, or to trust that they'll be okay afterwards. And that's essential. You know, our ability to handle stress and fear is very much a skill that we can develop and learn over time. And kids need opportunities to do that. The you know, impetus is on the parents to make sure that they're doing it in a way that the child is ready for, that the child, you know, can handle, and to not traumatize your children. But there is a balance there, and it is an important skill. And one of the biggest differences I saw when I was in Bogota versus the U.S. is that there, you know, the message is very much, when you experience this, you know, pickpocketing, or, you know, street harassment, or, you know, when your phone is stolen, this is what you will do, and you'll be okay. Whereas here, the message is so much on avoidance. Well, don't go there. Don't do this. And so you're never really allowing the message to get through that you can deal with this, that you can fall down and get back up and be okay.
Thanks for the call, Bill. Let me ask you about your experience at Eastern State Penitentiary, you know, one of our beloved landmarks here in the city of Philadelphia. And you went into this was a penitentiary at the time considered a reformist place. But
yes.
It drove many people really bonkers.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was all about being penitent and being in a cell by yourself and solitary confinement in many ways.
Yeah, it was, you know, best intentions and just absolute worst outcomes. You know, the idea was that you know, people who had done wrong, who were you know, in the penitentiary, would have time to reflect on their sins and repent and you know, come out after having
better.
Grown. Yeah, better. And the reality is that isolation, confinement, is just absolutely debilitating for the human. We need interaction. We need to be together. We need to talk. We need to connect. And without that, we fall apart physically, mentally. We just are meant and have, you know, evolved to be together. So my time at Eastern State, I really wanted to think about that a lot, to think about how important it is to have connection, to be together, and how traumatizing and really torturous solitary confinement is.
You went into the hole, right?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, so, yeah. They have the punishment cells that were underground, where inmates would be sent when they, you know, had done something wrong. And there they were kept in windowless cells with no interaction, with, you know, no light. And it's devastating. You know, the brain is meant to process. You know, our brain wants to process all information all the time, sort of like a mouse on a spinning wheel. We need to process information. And when you take away everything, we're left to nothing but what's in our own mind. And that's why people who are in sensory deprivation situations will start hallucinating or hear things that aren't there, because our brain is saying, I need to do something. I have to process. And so it can drive you insane very quickly.
Was it a different kind of fear to be in that darkness for you?
It is a different kind of fear. You know, the external world is very scary, but our brains are very scary too. And where our thoughts go, especially in the context of being in a prison, you know, it's going to take you to some very specific kinds of thoughts. And so you can't help but think about, you know, things that you've done wrong, and everyone has done something wrong.
Sure.
And when you're in a space like that, that's where all the focus goes. And so it becomes a negative kind of spiral of just sort of self-criticism. And the idea that that would be beneficial for anyone, you know, let alone people who are trying to be rehabilitated, is just illogical. So it was a very emotionally intense experience for me, and definitely moved me to places that resulted in a lot of personal growth.
Let me see what Jake from Langhorne has to say. Jake, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, hi. Hi. Quick question for you. For the professionals that do this on a daily basis, they don't know what's coming around the corner. How do they perceive fear and how do they control it so this does not impact their job?
That's interesting. Have you thought about that?
Well, I guess professionals in terms of like law enforcement, soldiers, things
sure,
like that.
Sure.
Yeah, I think that they, go to a whole new level of emotional regulation and, are taught the skills to anticipate threat and be prepared for it. You can do a lot of training of how you respond to stress. You know, you can really practice your threat response and bring a level of control to it. And what's interesting is you do see that it's people who are in law enforcement or who are in, intense kind of, soldiers, things like that, can have these emotional regulation skills, but also Buddhist monks and, people who are very into different types of meditation. It's all about emotional regulation and keeping that connection between your thinking brain and your limbic system very strong.
An email from Jason. Can these types of safe, scary experiences help those who suffer from PTSD or perhaps depression? I know you've looked at some of the experiments, or I guess the science related to this.
Yeah, the there are a lot of research protocols going on that look at bringing people who have PTSD more in touch with their body and their physical response. You know, some of that has been done in looking at PTSD in yoga. And a very similar sort of format can be used in sort of voluntarily engaging with scary things in a safe environment. You know, taking people who have PTSD or even high anxiety into a situation where they can essentially practice their threat response and become more comfortable with some of the triggers that they may associate with a flashback, increasing heart rate, sweaty palms. In a different environment, now they're becoming more comfortable with it. And it's sort of similar to kind of, exposure therapy, but more than anything, it's learning to be comfortable with your body, learning about your body.
And is there, we talk about hair-raising experiences, do we know, does scary fun or just scary stuff, does it raise our hairs?
Yeah, the piloerection, the our goosebumps, things that, when we get chills, they can be caused by a lot of things. They think that the goosebumps, the hair standing on end in times of fear, could potentially be an evolutionary kind of holdover from, previous species who
we had more fur.
Porcupines, people, right. Things that kind of puff up when they're afraid. But sometimes goosebumps are just if we have a fever or something or get chills, it's just our body responding to being overheated or. But the chills down the spine is a phenomena that many are probably familiar with or have experienced in walking through spooky places or just thinking about something scary and all of a sudden you get that shiver. And that's a response that I think is fascinating. And there's been some recent research looking at the ASMR, the
autonomous sensory meridian response.
Yes, which is a little bit more than the goosebumps. It's described as, starting sort of at in your head and this very intense tingles all the way down the spine and through your body and a feeling of euphoria. And there's a lot of controversy, a lot of debate over whether or not it's a real kind of separate thing outside of what we already know about the sympathetic nervous system. But to talk to those who experience it is really interesting. They, can sort of trigger these ASMR reactions by doing things like listening to very soothing music or whispering or, things that I associate with haunted houses, just sort of spooky sounds and noises. And but it is it's a cool physiological kind of experience.
And it has a name, ASMR.
Yeah.
Let me get, looks like Rob from Exton to join our conversation. Hi, Rob. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, I was wondering if different levels of stimulation can activate different responses. For myself, I really dislike Ferris wheels, but I love roller coasters. And I was just wondering if there's been any research that suggests, you can, at one level of stimulation, you've engaged stress, but you haven't really gotten enough stimulation to get an endorphin rush or something like that.
Well, even before we hear from Marky Rob, I'm just curious, from your own experience, are you frightened on a Ferris wheel or you just don't enjoy it?
There, it's kind of a mix. I mean, there is some fear there, and I don't know if it goes to goes back to what your guest said. You know, I tease people that it's on a roller coaster, you would die so quick you wouldn't even be aware that there was a problem. Where the Ferris wheel, you can kind of imagine slowly falling over.
Oh,
and yeah,
I hear you, Rob. Go ahead, Margie.
Yeah, I think that that you just hit the nail on the head there. It's what you're thinking about. On a Ferris wheel, you've got all that time to think about how you could fall and how you would just tumble slowly or maybe get caught in the complex kind of wheels or wires. And you've got a lot of time to think about it and then work yourself into kind of a state of anxiety and panic. Whereas on a roller coaster, it's, you know, over pretty quickly and you don't have time to think. You don't have time to sort of imagine all the different possibilities. But that, you know, there are very different sensations. Some people do not like that stomach drop feeling, like when you're taking off on an airplane. And that's a very different sensation than, say, being startled by a sound or being shocked. So, you know, it can just be a preference to it. You know, a lot of people don't like that stomach drop feeling.
Thanks for the call, Rob. Let's see what Lisa from Logan Square has to say. Hi, Lisa. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
I was wondering if anyone has monitored carts while you're going down a ride, because I was told that raising your arms up in the air and screaming on the way down is to make sure you take a deep breath at the top. Once I went down and I forgot to breathe at the top, and I felt like my chest was being crushed and I was going to die. And I'm just wondering, did my heart stop?
Well, you're here with us, Lisa. So if it did, it was very momentary. Go ahead, Margie.
I'm not sure if your heart stopped, but I do know that, you know, when you are, you know, pummeling towards the earth, the gravity working on us and on our bodies does induce a feeling of our hearts being crushed or our body being crushed in a way, because that force, the G-force, is working against us. And it's not something that we're used to, for sure. Our body wasn't designed to go at these breakneck speeds. So it does feel like we're being crushed sometimes. And some people like that feeling, others not so much.
But it is true that people on roller coasters have their hands over their head. Is that just sort of a natural response?
It does make it more intense. And, you know, I don't know exactly why. There hasn't been a lot of data, you know, physiological data collected with people riding roller coasters, and hopefully there will be soon. But you know, it does kind of make it more intense when your arms are up in the air.
So. Well, we're going to close things out with Godzilla. Uh-huh. We have a little clip from Godzilla. Are there certain monsters that you find scary?
I love monsters. I love to fear monsters. And my favorite horror movies, my favorite types of kind of character scares are monsters. I love them all. I haven't met a monster I haven't liked yet.
Yeah. The bigger, the badder, the louder, the scare, all of
that. Yeah. I guess I like all monsters. I just think that they're great. I love the imagination behind monsters. It's just such a great reflection of what's happening in any given time and place. So, yeah, they're just full of hidden messages.
And do zombies, does that figure into your love of monsters, or are they in a separate category?
They're in a somewhat separate category. Yeah, the more human the monster, the less I tend to like them. I mean, you know, just... Yeah. But zombies, I think, are very full of lots of social meaning, too. But yeah, my favorite monsters are the big, hairy, sort of kind of crazy, sharp-toothed monsters.
And we're almost out of time here. Does studying scary stuff make it still fun and exciting?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
It doesn't take away the thrill.
No. Yeah. I can, if I want to go and go through a haunted house and be scared, all I have to do is say, you know what, just lean in, engage, you know, suspend all disbelief and have a great time. And it's wonderful.
Well, Margie Kerr, it's been a lot of fun. Thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you.
And her book is called Scream: Chilling Adventures in the Science of Fear. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and we do want to close things out. And this is from the 2014 version of Godzilla. People screaming and running in terror from Godzilla, and then he lets out a fearsome wail.